And it is 22 and a half past the hour. It's a Transcendent Tuesday, and Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Don is a biochemist, the only scientist we have on staff here at Broken Road Radio. And he's also a vintner and a member of the Board of Creation Moments. And Don joins us just about every Tuesday morning, and we talk about things biblical, things like, creation. And you did a great series with us on Genesis. And we've still got people, you know, I mentioned to you, we had a security glitch on the website, and it meant going back to reestablishing an old what do they call it, a point in history when, and we lost some podcasts. We're still putting those back up when we can, but had somebody complain. I'm trying to follow your series in Genesis with Dr. Don, and some of them are missing. And I said, yeah, we're doing our best, and we'll get them eventually back up there too. Don, today, I've got to tell you, Amber has fascinated me. I think that's because I have a fascination with anything encased in clear stuff. You know, like things in acrylic or snow globes or any of that stuff. I've often fantasized, what if I were in there? What if I were inside looking out? And Amber... And
I say, and then you couldn't get out. I mean, that would be an interesting thought.
I don't like to think about that part. Being claustrophobic, that would be terrible. But just the beauty of such things. Old paperweights, which were made by French and Scottish glass artists just to have something to do during downtimes, the beautiful orbs of glass with intricate designs. We're talking about amber today, which has been around, I guess, since forever, huh? Have you ever seen a piece of amber with a critter in it?
I don't believe. I may be in a museum or something like that, but, it's not something you ordinarily would find lying around because it takes several years for the tree sap. Amber comes from tree sap, and so obviously you need trees in order to have amber. What makes amber interesting is that it traps all kinds of critters, that happen to be on the tree at the time the tree sap kind of oozes over the critter. So they've found amber with worms, frogs, lizards, crustaceans, spiders, insects, even cockroaches and bees, entrapped in the amber. Of course, when the insect or the creature is trapped, the amber is gooey and sticky, like you would find, for example, around here we have a lot of pine trees. So you can find pine sap on the trees, and it's very, very sticky. And if you get it on your car, it's hard to get off the car. But eventually, over time and with sunlight, it hardens into... It polymerizes, if you will, and it hardens into a nice, clear, yellowish, almost amber color.
The name.
And then it's preserved almost indefinitely. What makes amber interesting is because it is actually a dilemma for evolutionists because of these creatures that have been entrapped in amber. There's a lot of the amber that was formed before the flood when there was a lot of obviously creatures around. If you believe in the creation story, God created the heavens and the earth and everything in it. He created them after their kind. So we're not surprised to find, creatures entrapped in the amber.
There was a story out just several weeks ago about a piece of amber that was found containing what they called at the time the world's smallest dinosaur. Now, I don't know how physically big this amber can't get very big, I don't think. You don't see it like a pound of it. You see, they're like amulet size thing because they've been used in jewelry for eons. They've since decided, no, it's just a little lizard. False alarm.
there is an artifact in the Smithsonian, not the Smithsonian, the what's the museum in Moscow? Hermitage. It's called the Amber Room.
Yeah, I just saw a picture of that. Yeah,
and it's a huge, huge, great big giant-sized, and you can walk into it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, of course, it's not just a little one drop of amber, but there's a bunch of it. And they stuck them together.
And you could, one could imagine, for example, you could get larger size amber if you have larger trees. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, before the flood, we did have large trees. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can go to California, go to Sequoia National Park and see some huge sequoias, but those trees are just since the time of the flood, which would put it about 4,500 years ago. But if you had trees growing before the flood, the environment was almost perfect. Matter of fact, it was perfect after God's creation. If you go back to the Genesis series on the podcast, so they would have grown much, much bigger than they are today. But back, be that as it may, I mean, we could have bigger pieces of amber, for example, before that time. But be that as it may, you know, a lot of the amber has been dated back to the mid-Cretaceous period, which makes it, in the evolutionary time scale, 90 million years old. And that poses a problem for evolutionists because the insects, for example, that are trapped in the amber look like insects today. And there's no difference in evolution from the insects found in the amber and the insects today, just as well as the other animals that they find. But
by the way, I just put a link in the Broken Road Radio chat window, a link to the picture of that amber room in Russia. And it's a series of, it's like a slideshow of amber. So it's some beautiful pictures in that. So if somebody's handy there, you might want to go to the chat window, click on that link, and take a look at what we're talking about.
So anyway, the a recent find in Myanmar, that is Burma, they found three fossil insects entombed in amber. And what makes the discovery amazing is that there was a, there's a wasp, a beetle, and a fly were dated to about 99 million years old, but they have their true color and could be identified by the colors on the insects. Now, colors on insects, it's not like, and it's the same mechanism for the colors on the insects as it is on a butterfly, for example. We see various blues and reds and things on a butterfly. These insects had this iridescent coloration as well. And the iridescent colors are not due to pigmentation. They are due to very tiny striations in the exoskeleton of the insect. And so let me explain that a little bit. You can separate colors. Let's say if you had a white beam, for example, you can separate the colors in that beam. Of course, we know from high school physics class or from experiments that we do, you get a little science kit and it has a prism in it. So you can, take a light that's coming through and it'll separate the colors that's in the light into the light spectrum. Well, there's another way of doing that. That is to take a plate, and it could be, metal plate or whatever, and engrave very, very tiny lines in it. And then these tiny lines also act like a prism, and it reflects the colors based on the angle that you're looking at this plate with lines. That's exactly the same thing that's on the insects, for example. Or it's, very, very similar to what you would see if you have a soap bubble and you see these swirling colors on the surface of the soap bubble, it's due to this interference, you know, pattern that is created by the tiny striations that are on the exoskeleton of the, in this case, of the insects. And so now you have a dilemma from an evolutionary point of view of, you know, why would an insect, of course you have this with modern insects as well, but why would the insect, you know, need colors to survive? You know, what's the point of having the blues and the greens and the purples, you know, that are clearly visible even through the amber? What's the purpose of that in the evolutionary you know, transitions of these insects into higher and higher life forms, when they appear to serve no purpose, but there they are? And so it creates, of course, a dilemma for the evolutionist. It doesn't create a dilemma for the creationist, because we say, wow, you know, that if the colors serve no purpose, now that's not to say that they don't, because, you know, we color, for example, we know with bees, color is very, very important for them to find the flowers that, or other insects, you know, to find the flower that they are looking at, or, you know, that they go and pollinate and collect the pollen from. Some insects are very, very specific to certain types of flowers. So the color of the flower, then their eyes pick up sometimes UV light, which even gives it a different appearance to their eyes versus our eyes. And they are attracted more to those flowers that they actually go and pollinate and get their pollen. So color does form a very, very specific function within the insect kingdom, if you will. But, you know, what the coloration on a body of an insect, it's like, okay, what's that for? Maybe it's for attraction.
I have a question there, because I know that some insects have certain color patterns recognized by those other species that feed on them, and some of them even mimic the look of poisonous insects so that they won't, you know, birds or lizards won't eat them. And now I don't know whether that's they evolved the colors in order to defend themselves, or the predatory species simply learned that they're poison and they avoid it. So that's a learning thing, not an evolutionary thing. But isn't that common in the insect world?
It can be, yeah, it can be common that the insect, you know, has this coloration that in some cases attracts the predator, which is not to the insect's, you know, advantage, obviously.
That'd be an evolutionary goof, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So that wouldn't work from an evolutionary point of view. It would be beneficial to the bird or whatever is, you know, eating the insect. But, you know, as far as coloration to deter its predator from eating it, of course, would be an advantage. Regardless of what the reason for the coloration is, the fact that this structure appears, these iridescent structures appear on these insects in the amber, if you are, you know, considering that these are indeed, you know, 99 million years old, which of course we know they're not from a creation point of view, but if you are considering the old Earth time frame, then you have a problem, because why would such sophisticated structures even be that far advanced at that young age in quote the evolutionary process? So these ambered and trapped, you know, species that are found, whether it's an insect or a frog or whatever, you got a problem from an evolutionary point of view, because it all points to the fact that they have not changed over the millions and millions of years that supposedly these ambers represent. And so if they don't change, then you can't have evolution, because obviously evolution means change. Well, the original thought behind evolution was that there was gradual change over a long period of time. So we're not getting gradual change. It's as if they were created after their own kind from the very beginning, which brings us back to, of course, Genesis, which states that very fact in the first chapter of the Bible. First chapter of Genesis, first chapter of the Bible, that states that everything was created after their own kind. So the creationist is not surprised by any of this, but the evolutionist is puzzled.
Here's a comment from the article. This is an Institute of Creation Research article. There's a link, by the way, on the BrokenRoadRadio.com website there. An evolutionist who wasn't part of the study that they're talking about here, University of West Virginia paleobiologist James Lamsdell, and this is a quote from him. He says, "They seem to have each evolved iridescent traits independently. And although scientists can speculate as to what evolutionary pressures drove all these different insects to iridescence, there is no way to know for sure. The significance of iridescence remains elusive," he says. So evolution has no answer for this.
They have no answer. And, of course, you know, the creationist answer is they were created that way from the very beginning. God wanted them to have iridescence, you know, for whatever reason. And they do. And so we're not puzzled by it. But, of course, the evolutionists are.
Do you suppose God ever created anything just because it was beautiful? And it didn't need a function?
Well, I think there's a lot of function in color, as I've, you know, mentioned earlier. But I think we're going to be so surprised when we get to heaven that it's going to be so colorful that our physical bodies, as we know them, you know, today won't be, I mean, we would be blown away by the majesty of the color that we're going to see. And my mind is brought back to Moses, of course, when Moses is up on Mount Sinai and is asking God, you know, he wants to see God. He's excited. You know, here's God writing with his very fingers the Ten Commandments on stone, you know, on a rock. And Moses said, "I want to see you. I want to see you." And God's saying, "You can't see me or else you're going to die, because of my glory is so intense that you wouldn't survive in your sinned state, if you will." Not that Moses was full of sin, but, you know, just being this side of the fall, I mean, we can't see God directly in our current condition. So God's compromises and said, "Okay, you go in the crack, this big crack, the cleft in the rock, and I'm going to pass by. And after I pass by, I'm going to say it's okay, and then you can look." And so that's exactly what God does. Moses, God says, "Okay, it's you know, okay to look." And Moses just sees the tailings of God's glory, and he goes bananas. I mean, it's like, "Oh, praise you, Lord, glory to you." And, you know, he just can't imagine, you know, the glory that he sees in the kids. I'm just imagining that was so colorful, that it was so intense, the colors were so intense, that Moses got blown away from it. So, yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of color in heaven. The color is going to be so intense, it's going to literally blow us away. And, you know, God does these things because he is a God of glory. And, you know, he enjoys beauty, I'm sure.
Wasn't it somewhere in Paul's epistles he writes about being taken to the seventh heaven? I don't remember where that quote is, but he talks about things he saw there that man was not allowed to talk about or could not talk about. And I've heard from other sources, and these might have been some near-death experiences too, where they saw colors that had no name. They'd never seen colors like that before in whatever they experienced. So right. The idea that such colors can exist is nothing new, and it's intriguing.
Yeah, well, it is, because our eyes can only see a very limited you know, light spectrum. For example, our vision is very, very limited as far as the the spectrum, the radiation spectrum that's out there. You know, suppose that our spectrum was expanded and you could see far into the UV and far into the infrared, you know, you would see many, many more colors than we actually see, you know, right now with our physical, the limitations of our physical
body. I once talked to a Bible class about that, and I picked the idea of the whole radio spectrum, and I gave an example that if there was a piece of movie film that stretched from Seattle, Washington, down to San Diego, California, which is, what, 2,000 miles, something close to that, that the visible spectrum of light would encompass about an inch and a half of that film, and it would end up somewhere near San Francisco, somewhere in the middle of that whole spectrum. But either side of that range within which we can detect energy and get a response, things are happening throughout the spectrum that we have no idea about. No way to sense.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can sense it with instruments, of course.
But some of it, we can, but much of it we can't.
Yeah. So, you know, there's. I don't think there's going to be a limitation when we get to heaven as to what these colors are all about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be awesome.
Well, I'm eager for the words when we get up after the first couple nights of heaven and the announcement comes over the intercom system that just wait till you see what's happening today.
Right.
No limitations. We're talking with Don Clark, a member of the board of Creation Moments, and I'd like to recommend their website to you. It is creationmoments.com, and it's a reservoir, an archive of scientific information that explains, teaches, talks about the biblical story of creation, which in itself is extremely fascinating. And, you know, Genesis is, well, just the beginning of it. But I recommend you take a trip to there and see what they have to see and tune in with us next Tuesday, too, when Don returns. And we'll talk about something else having to do with biblical creation and evolution. Don, thanks very much. Appreciate having you around today.
All righty. Very good. Good to be here.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
So long.